From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello, I'm very pleased to be joined today by Alison Savas, a member of the investment team at Antipodes Partners, who moved to London last year to set up a UK office for the Australian investment firm. Alison, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So Antipodes, you guys are a value-focused Australian equity boutique, as in the firm is Australian. You don't just focus on Australian equities. But what more should we know about it?
Yeah, so that's right. Antipodes is a global equities firm. We started the business in 2015 and headquartered in Sydney, Australia, as you called out, and we have offices in London and also in North America. So, you know, as you said, we are a value bias manager. We do take a pragmatic approach to value investing. And look, we have around $7 billion in assets under management. That's in US dollars. And that AUM is split roughly between, predominantly split between a global long strategy and a global long short strategy. Now, that long short strategy is net invested in the market, so it'll always have a long bias. And the long books of both strategies are joined at the hip. That's how we describe it. But what you can expect from Antipodes is a portfolio that looks, you know, very different from the benchmark and often does look very different from our peers.
Okay. And we'll certainly come on to that more. And Jacob Mitchell is the lead manager, right? I mean, can you tell us a little bit about him and his reputation in Australia?
Yeah, look, Jacob has, he's a 30-year veteran of the Australian funds management industry.
He worked at a big firm called Platinum.
That's correct, yes. He worked.
Perhaps you did as well?
Yes, I did as well. That's right. So we've got a long history together. But yeah, that's right. Look, he's very well regarded in the Australian funds management industry. And he did establish Antipodes with a very solid track record leading into that. I reflect on how clients think about him, you know, I do think what they value from Jacob is his breadth of knowledge, you know, his ability to discuss pretty complex issues, and also the depth of which he can discuss markets as well as stocks. So, you know, I do think he's a considered and thoughtful investor, and also a genuinely nice guy and pretty humble man. So that's how I describe
him. Well, that's good to hear. And so why did you move to the UK? I can imagine, you know, the weather's not quite as good as Sydney, as you've alluded to.
So it wasn't the weather. we do have a very strong business and client support in Australia, but we're also very well supported by asset consultants. So we do have clients in the UK, Canada and the US. And so part of the move here was really to support the clients in the Northern Hemisphere and also to introduce Antipodes to, you know, to new clients and help build the business grow in this part of the world.
Yeah, and how's it been so far?
Yeah, look, I mean, still, you know, in terms of when I think about my day-to-day, you know, we are meeting clients, which is fantastic, but still very connected into the portfolio management team and still continuing my normal role, which it really is to talk to clients, tell them what we're thinking about markets, what we're seeing, and how we're expressing that in the portfolio. So that does cover the day-to-day. It keeps me busy.
Okay. And have you had more of an eye on UK and European stocks since you moved here, or is it not quite work like that?
Six months ago, the UK was a really big topic of discussion because what we could see at that time was inflation was still really high relative to, you know, this is probably now looking 6 to 9 months ago, inflation was still really high relative to the US. And, you know, the BOE, the rhetoric coming out of the BOE was still really hawkish. And, you know, what we know about the UK economy is that it is an import-dependent economy. Mm. And we could see inflation, you know, if we were looking at China was experiencing deflation in PPI. So we knew it was a matter of time before that fed into UK imports. So we took the view that inflation would catch down, I guess, in the UK with the rest of the world.
Which has started to happen.
Which is what has happened. And it has given the BOE, that wiggle room. Mm. And so, you know, really it was around, as I said, that 6 to 9 months ago where we were increasing our exposure to UK equities. And the UK is probably around 6 to 7% of our portfolio, really anchored by Tesco, which is one of our, which I believe is still in our top 10, but it's one of our larger holdings.
Okay, great. So, yeah, so about twice the global benchmark there.
Well, okay. Europe certainly is twice the global benchmark. And, you know, what's interesting about Europe is valuations are low, you know, and you've sort of alluded to that in your question anyway. You know, the headline multiple of European equities is around 13 times. So we are overweight the benchmark in Europe, but where that overweight really focuses is on global multinationals. Now, these are companies that are listed in Europe, but they're global leaders and they generate their earnings globally. And in fact, many of these businesses, certainly the ones in our portfolio, they generate a large proportion of their earnings in the US. So it is a way, you know, we certainly do look at that as a way for us to take or get exposure to that very resilient US economy in a way where the valuation, is more attractive. And a really good example of that would be a company like Siemens. You know, this is it's a you know well-known industrial conglomerate. Mm-hmm. It is a global leader in factory automation. It does the hardware and the software. It's one of the only companies globally that does both hardware and software. And we know that manufacturing lines need to be redesigned and retooled in a low-carbon world. And it's also got great exposure to electrification through its smart infrastructure division, through rail. It does the signalling equipment. Rail is the most environmentally friendly form of transport. You know, it's critical for reducing emissions in the transport sector. And we can buy Siemens today on around 12, 13 times earnings, with those earnings growing at 10% per annum. So really, you know, that's sort of how it's stocks like those that's really, you know, found their way into our portfolio and why we're overweight Europe.
Okay. Well, coming on a bit more to the portfolio and the process, you know, I was looking at the fact sheet for your global long fund, where, you know, for a value manager or a value-minded manager, people might be surprised to see the likes of Microsoft in there. And, you know, it's on almost the same weighting of the portfolio as Total, the French energy company.
Yes.
So you know, how does your process throw up both of those stocks, both on the same weighting?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I might start by answering, well, you know, what is pragmatic value? So at Antipodes, what we are looking for is companies that are mispriced relative to their business resilience and their growth profile. And we will look across the spectrum of growth to find those opportunities. Mm-hmm. So we do have stocks in the portfolio that are GDP plus-like growers. And they are typically on low multiples. But they're market leaders and they're not under a threat of disruption. And so Total fits into that sort of grouping of exposure.
Okay.
But then at the other end of the spectrum, we do have exposure to companies that are on an optically high multiple, but they're cheap relative to their growth profile and they're cheap relative to their peers. And so Microsoft will fall into that bucket of exposure. And so at Antipodes, our view is that there is a place for a Total and a Microsoft in a pragmatic value portfolio. Now, in terms of process, which I think is...
Can I just jump in and say, I know the word pragmatic value...
Yes.
You know, was that always part of the kind of the badging, the billing, or is that something you guys have kind of put in there during the values wilderness years?
No. It's always been there. And the rationale behind that was, I think, you know, how that, you know, it's sort of, I guess, obvious how that differs from that more traditional approach to value investing is, you know, the risks we see in that dogmatic approach to value investing is that what it can miss, well what it weds to is owning low multiple stocks with an expectation of mean reversion. And what that can miss is structural change in an industry. And that's where a company is being outcompeted or worse, permanently impaired by the competition. And so it's cheap for a reason. That's the classic value trap. And we don't want to own those sorts of businesses regardless of how cheap they become.
Yeah.
So, the pragmatic, pragmatic approach to value investing, you know, what we're really focused on there is owning resilient businesses. You know, it's not owning, you know, we don't want to own a weak business on a low multiple. So we want to own resilient businesses but we want to be disciplined around the price we pay for that business. There's no point in paying any price.
Yeah.
You need to have that margin of safety. So, you know, that's, I guess, you know, when you take the likes of a Total and a Microsoft, you know, it fits the bill. You know, both of them are resilient businesses and both of them are cheap relative to their respective growth profiles. Mm. And you know, when we look at that valuation piece, it is about thinking about the valuation relative to growth, valuation relative to business resilience, but then also contextualising that valuation. How is this company priced today relative to its peers, compared to how it's typically been priced relative to its peers? And so it's all those elements that come together and that which impacts whether a stock can get into the portfolio, but also what that final position size will be.
Okay. What would you say your guys' kind of edge is in applying that pragmatic value approach?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think firstly, you know, for clients who are looking to allocate to value, well, firstly, having a pragmatic approach to value investing is, you know, certainly our view is that is a competitive edge. You know, we do believe that it will generate a smoother journey through the cycle compared to a more traditional approach to value investing. So there was that element of it. And then in terms of our process, the way we undertake that research process at Antipodes, we call it the industry-led research approach. So what we do is we start broad before we go deep into any one individual name. Because we want to get a picture of what this industry is going to look like over the next 5 to 10 years' time and really get, you know, understand the lay of the land. So what we're focused here is on understanding, you know, what is the change that's taking place in this industry, whether that is cyclical change, structural change, or socio-macro change. And we want to position ahead of that change. So we do that big piece of work first, and once we get a sense of what's going on, what drops from that piece of research is our potential winners, so our potential longs, and our potential losers, and they're our potential shorts. And from there, that's where we then move into the individual investment case.
Gotcha. And is this, you use something called clusters in your process. Is that related or?
It is.
Or
it is.
The same?
It's related. So what we find with that industry-led research approach is that the market often misprices more than one stock around a similar investment thesis.
Right.
And so what that allows us to do is to build high conviction portfolios without having to take excessive risk in any one individual name. So as an example, the long book in the strategies would have roughly 60 stocks in it. But many of them do play to this play to a similar investment thesis. And then the way we think about, and then we do, I think, another really important part of managing money is that portfolio construction piece. So we do look at the correlations in our portfolios, you know, because really, you know, we do invest with a capital preservation mindset. So we really do want to understand, you know, at the end of the day, what are our real underlying exposures are, and what is our concentration risk in our portfolio, and managing that concentration risk, because we want to reduce our exposure to unforeseen risk. Because the reality is that in markets, things happen that you just don't predict. And unfortunately, you know, sometimes we'll get things wrong. And so by managing that correlation risk in the portfolio, it is, as I said, about reducing unforeseen risk in the portfolio.
Okay, thanks. I just want to talk about performance a bit. So, you know, I think performance was pretty good in the first few years after Antipodes was founded in 2015. And, you know, you also had a resilient 2022, you know, versus the wider market when interest rates started to rise. But otherwise, you've struggled a bit to keep up with, you know, benchmarks during a really strong period of markets. I suppose, what lessons have you taken from that, and what's going to change?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, when you look back on particularly the last 5 years, stylistically, it's been pretty tough. It's been a pretty tough environment for value funds. It's been a very growth-driven market. And, you know, when we look at 2023, you know, it was a very narrow market. You know, we know that almost all of the performance of last year was driven by just a handful of names.
Yeah.
And so that has been a tricky environment for a value-biased fund. But look, you know, the global long strategy, you know, we invest over a 3 to 5 year horizon. The global long strategy has outperformed the value benchmark over 2 years and 5 years.
Okay.
And look, I think when clients do take exposure to Antipodes, we are the value piece in their portfolio. And so, that, you know, there is an acknowledgement of when it's a really growthy market, it's going to be hard to keep up.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean we don't want to outperform, because we absolutely do.
You know, in fairness, we should say, you know, I've got some figures, I think, from your last quarterly report. And so, yeah, for the Global Long Fund from inception in 2015, it's returned about 8.2% per annum. That's in dollars, I think. You know, versus the All Country World Index, 8.5%.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, I'm not saying it's loads behind.
Yes.
But maybe in the last few years, it has been a more difficult period.
Look, you're absolutely right. It has been tricky. And you know, I guess in terms of, you know to answer your question, the lessons that have been learnt. Look, I think as investors, we always have to remember to continue to test our views as the macro and the backdrop evolves. And, you know, if I can point to, you know, I guess a really specific example in the very recent period, you know, I guess, you know, we didn't appreciate just the power of fiscal stimulus. And from the perspective of what that meant for liquidity, you know, what and in turn what that meant for the market, and also what that meant for the consumer. So, you know, as an example, the consumer's been in a really strong position, and that's what's powered the US economy. So the US economy's been more resilient than we expected. So I think, you know, it is, you know, we've got to continue to retest our views. But at the end of the day, we aren't changing what we do, you know, because our view is that, you know, if we stick to our knitting, we buy resilient businesses on, you know, on attractive valuations, that is what will lead to generating alpha over the long term. And once you start to sacrifice your margin of safety or your valuation, that is when you risk capital destruction. Now, you know, where to from here, or what do we think is going to change? I think, you know, we all know this, but we know that the performance of the market last year was incredibly narrow. And, you know, today we're in a situation where the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500, they account for 33% of the S&P 500 in a market cap sense. So 33% right. of the market cap and 25% of earnings. We are at, you know, today this is a multi-decade high level of market concentration and narrowness of return. So it's highly unusual. I mean, it certainly has happened in the past, but it's not common and it doesn't typically persist. So when we look at these periods when this has happened in the past, what the data shows us is that in the 12 months past that peak concentration,
right.
you actually see momentum reversing. And that reversal is led by...
It can only go so far.
That's right. It can only go so far. But what's interesting is that in every instance, that reversal is led by low momentum stocks catching up. Now, it doesn't mean your high momentum stocks stop performing, but it's actually your low momentum stocks catching up. And really what's that saying is that you actually just get a broadening in the market. So today, when we sit here today, the way we're thinking about portfolio construction is we're taking a barbell approach. So absolutely, we want to take pragmatic value exposure to these really interesting investment themes around AI and cloud monetization and around the energy transition, where the valuation makes sense. But we also, you know, through looking at the data, you know, we know that we will get this pivot and we want to be positioned for that. So we've also, you know, in the last 6 months really been looking at some of these global cyclicals that have become incredibly washed out. That's because we've had a very weak industrial production cycle.
Any examples?
Oh, we're sort of finding them. We've been quite selective.
Is the portfolio chock full of them?
I know. I wouldn't say we're chock full of them. There's room to add more. But, you know, it's been in autos. It's been in global chemicals. You know, some broader industrial names. But really, you know, I guess, you know, what we're, you know, earlier last year it was adding to energy. Now, it's not going to be all cyclicals are going to be great investments, so we're not piling in. But what I would say is that there are certainly some that are showing, there are pockets of the market that are showing those classic bottom of the cycle characteristics around inventory destocking, low levels of inventory, weak pricing, where on our analysis, the longer term supply and demand dynamics still look really attractive, and valuations are low. So look, it's been about pivoting into some of those names, you know, to position for, you know, our expectation of this broadening in the market.
Okay, thanks. I'll bring you back to the Magnificent Seven for a last time.
Yes.
As you said, you know, as well as a global long fund, you run a long short strategy. You know, like many fund managers, you don't disclose all the names you're shorting, so there are some restrictions. However, I know you are shorting both Apple and Tesla.
Yes.
That must have been quite a brave decision, given what happened last year. Are they long-running shorts?
No. So look, the way we approach the short book is quite different from the long book.
Okay.
So I might start there just very quickly.
Sure.
So when we think about, you know, when we think about the long book, what we're looking for as companies, you know, I've spoken about business resilience and margin of safety valuation. Now, the way we think about business resilience is we're looking for stocks that have multiple ways of winning. That's how we talk about it internally. So really simply, the more ways we can win from owning a stock, in all likelihood, the greater the quality of that business franchise and the greater the position sizing in the portfolio. Now, when it comes to the short book, what we're looking for there is companies where we see multiple ways of losing, where there is a really wide margin of, or a high margin of error in that investment thesis. So what I mean by that is a really wide range of outcomes.
There's a lot that could go wrong.
And there is no margin of safety. Now, so that's how we look for idiosyncratic shorts. But the way we manage risk in the short book is also different. So position sizing, individual shorts are much, much smaller than individual longs, you know, for some of the reasons you've already sort of alluded
to. Sure. I mean, Tesla is a stock that some people have lost a lot of money shorting.
Yes. So we keep the position sizing short, smaller. We are much more focused around the timing of the short, and also the holding period is much, much smaller. So what we may be short today, we're not necessarily going to be short in a month or 2 months' time. The shorts do tend to come on and off much more dynamically than what happens in the long book. The long book is managed very differently from that. So look, you know...
But nonetheless, those two names, I guess, are a signal that however long you had them on, you know, you're kind of betting against.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But we won't be short them. I guess my point is we're not short them all the time.
Right.
And, you know, if we do feel like the market is moving against us or momentum is moving against us, you know, it's the right decision is to take them off or wait for a more opportunistic time. So we do have a fundamental case, but the way we have them or the exposure to them can be much more dynamic.
Yeah.
So that is how we think about the short book. Now, I guess, you know, with the Apple short, it's a relatively simple case around, we think that on the handset side, that the upgrade cycle is lengthening. And that's really being driven by smaller incremental changes to handsets, you know, and so lengthening that cycle. We also think there's risks around Apple losing market share in China, you know, both because you've got Huawei emerging as, you know, really taking share. It's experiencing a really... it's experiencing success, and also geopolitical risks as well. And it's not clear to us that, losses in market share in China, losing volumes in China, can be made up by an acceleration of growth in the rest of the world or let's say India. And we're also seeing slowing attach rates on services. So people are spending more on existing services but not adding to new services. And we just don't know what their AI strategy is yet. So we just don't think that is factored into the valuation of the stock. Now, whether or not, you know, that's working at the moment, whether or not we're short it in 2 months, we'll have to check in again.
Okay, we'll check in again. Last thing on the investment side I wanted to ask you about, Alison, is, you know, so you've got about, of the long fund, 18.6%. So, you know, getting on for a fifth in developing Asia and EM.
Yep.
You know, I suppose, what are you thinking about valuations there? What are you finding, particularly when it comes to China? Because I think maybe that's somewhere where you've still got more than a lot of your peers have.
Yes, we do. Look, we've got a low teens exposure to China. And you know, look, I think the China story is well understood. You know, the economy post-reopening has been, you know, very lackluster. Policymakers have taken a much more dogmatic approach to stimulus and certainly what we're expecting. And, you know, a weak property sector, and that's weighed on household and business confidence. And of course, you've had geopolitical issues. Now, all of these issues are known by the market. And that's why today Chinese equities at that headline level are on around 9x earnings. So you know, it is factored into the price. And in this, you know, sell-off of Chinese equities, some really interesting businesses have become available at really attractive valuations. So that's certainly one element of our emerging market leg to our portfolio. But actually, where we have been adding to over the last 12 months is we've been adding to Latin America.
All right.
The story is different there. You know, you've had inflation peaked. Now, rates were hiked very quickly in Latin America. So now we're already on the the rate cycle, the downward trajectory, rates mm-hmm. are falling, and fundamentals are improving. And valuations, EM's been out of favour, you know, so valuations are attractive. So, look, we've been able, as I said, that's a part of the market that we've been adding to over the last 12 months. We've got around 7% exposure there. And, you know, one company we really like is a stock called, in Brazil, Sendas Distribuidora. It's a cash and carry grocery retailer. You know, that format, cash and carry, is taking market share. Mm-hmm. And, you know, between Sendas and the other larger cash and carry operator, they've got 20% of the grocery market in Brazil. Now, with Sendas, the opportunity there was, a couple of years ago, they acquired a whole bunch of stores, and they used a lot of debt to do that in a time when interest rates were very high. And they had to close those stores because they needed to refurbish them so that they fit with that cash and carry format. So today we find ourselves in a situation where these stores have all reopened and they're maturing at a faster rate than what the market was expecting. And that's really driving same-store sales growth. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, you've got interest rates now falling. And so that interest burden is falling down. When we look at that business, when we look out to 2025 earnings, it's on around 9x earnings. So, you know, there's lots of parts of the market, you know, in this sort of fixation of what is now an increasingly smaller number of stocks. We started with 7 and I feel like now we're at, I don't know, 3 or 4. Mm. There's just parts of the market that are just being completely overlooked and there's lots of interesting businesses there. So that's certainly what we're on the hunt for.
Okay. A last stock we've got, I wanted to come back to China and ask about AI, actually. You know, we had another fund manager in here only the other day, a big tech fund manager, who was saying, how much they love AI, basically, and what a great opportunity it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because they mentioned Baidu, which was, for long years, what, you know, was a kind of AI hopeful before it was even such a big theme as it is today.
Yeah.
And you own Baidu, but they made a comment that, you know, maybe the kind of AI story sits slightly uncomfortably in a country like China where you have a lot of state control. I just wonder if you can talk about kind of AI and China a bit, and whether there's a kind of story being missed there.
Look, I think that is, you know, I think when we look at Baidu, it is a domestic champion. You know, it is the search business in China, and perhaps AI might be different in China than what we do see in the developed world. But it will still be implemented in a way that works for that particular economy, even if it looks slightly different.
Right.
And look, the way we think about Baidu is, if we look about. Look, Baidu has suffered from people not wanting to own China this year. Mm. But actually, its fundamentals have delivered. So when we look at its advertising revenue, it's growing at a mid-single-digit level. Now, in a better economic environment, you know, there's no reason that won't be high single digits. But then if we bring AI into the mix, you know, and they are investing in AI, you know, I think we can make a case where, you know, we do look to see how this has played out in the West in other like businesses, let's say. There's no reason to say why with Baidu that they're not going to implement AI in such a way where it does lead to better ad targeting, you know, and that leads to higher click-through rates, which leads to an ability to charge a higher advertising rate, which just leads to better monetization of time spent. Mm. So it might look a bit different, but I think there certainly are similarities. And yet today, because nobody wants, you know, China's unloved, we can buy Baidu today on 10 times core earnings, so 10 times that core advertising business.
Okay.
And this is a company where, you know, you, as I said, in a better macro backdrop, you can see it growing high single digits with some implementation of AI, maybe even a little bit better than that. And I don't think we're getting overly optimistic there. And it's got a really solid balance sheet and it's buying back stock. Mm-hmm. I think it does come back to what valuation is, you know, how is the market pricing these stocks?
Yeah.
And does that marry with, you know, the resilience of the business and what that growth profile might look like.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Alison. I think that's all we've got time for today. But great to meet you in person and thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.